We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host today, Ariel Garten. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. You can check out the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll find over 500 meditations on everything from sleep, stress, and anxiety to happiness, motivation, confidence, and so much more, all designed to inspire you to solve the big and little challenges we face in life and to be your best self every day. It's like having a little inspirational coach in your pocket. And we just launched two beautiful new sleep collections with music for you and your kiddos. Check it out. Today, join Muse co-founder, neuroscientist, brainiac, and Untangle co-host, Ariel Garten, as she goes inside the head of her amazing guests.
Thanks, Patricia. Hello, I'm Ariel, and I'll be your guide as we go inside the head of some of the world's most extraordinary brain scientists, psychologists, meditators, those who are skilled in the mental arts. And we're going to learn both from their cutting-edge work and their own human experience, how our brains work, how to optimize them, and how to manage the crazy in all of our minds. This week, we're going to get inside the head of Mark Lesser. Mark is a Zen Buddhist who holds an MBA from New York University, and he's founded and been the CEO of three companies. He's also a 10-year resident of the San Francisco Zen Center. He was the director of the Tassajara Zen Center, which was the first Zen center in the Western world. And he moves quite seamlessly from the worlds of business and Buddhism. I first met Mark in his journey at Search Inside Yourself, where he created a leadership program at Google. It was their emotional intelligence program, essentially meditation for Googlers. From his time at Google and Search Inside Yourself, Mark's created an amazing book called The Seven Practices of the Mindful Leader, where he distills the wisdom that he's discovered moving between Buddhism and the boardroom and back again. Today, our guest is Mark Lesser, and we are about to get inside his head and find out how you can become a mindful leader. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Ariel. It's a little scary. One of my favorite writers is Annie Lamont. Mm-hmm. And she famously says, "My mind is like a bad neighborhood. I don't go there anymore." So you got to be careful. I don't know if you want to be inside my head, but we'll try and keep it positive.
So Mark, let's begin by sharing a little bit about your fascinating background.
I took a 1-year leave of absence from Rutgers when I was in my early 20s on a kind of a spiritual search, looking for meaning or something that had more depth and meaning to it than what I was feeling in college. Came out to the West Coast and wandered into the San Francisco Zen Center. And actually, as soon as I walked into 300 Page Street, which is the city center in San Francisco, there was a voice inside this head that said, I think this place is going to be worth 10 years of my life.
Wow. How old were you this time?
I would have been 22.
Okay. At which point 10 years was half of your life to that date.
Yes. Never quite looked at it that way, but yeah. And I did end up staying for 10 years. One of the big surprises was how important work was and the integration of mindfulness practice, you know, spiritual practice, Zen practice, and work. And I think that's one of the things that I've always appreciated about the Zen tradition is that it really does put work on a pedestal as a core way of learning, as a core way of practicing. And there's lots of stories. I think there was a famous Japanese Zen master who said, you know, a day of no work is a day of no eating, you know, kind of putting that we need to work every day. And I got to do some amazing things in the work world that clearly, had I stayed in New Jersey, would not have happened. I got asked to figure out how to farm with horses at Zen Center's Green Gulch Farm, and that was amazing. The year after that, I was asked to be the assistant cook to the kitchen in a Zen monastery at Tassajara. And then the following year, I was the head cook for a year. And it was that experience in particular, the experience of running a Zen monastery kitchen, there was something quite magical about work, the practice of work, this strange blend of effort and effortlessness, this sense that you were practicing by yourself and what you did separately mattered, but that you were intimately connected with the people that you were working with and that you were part of a tradition. You're part of a cooking tradition that had a reputation for producing the highest quality, creative, vegetarian food. And that's one of the reasons people came. People came to Tassajara for the food was actually one of the big motivations for people coming and staying in this mountain valley that is not so easy to get to.
So you were in this kitchen. What were the lessons that you learned? I mean, when we imagine a kitchen, we're thinking, you know, all of the cooking shows that you see these days where a chef has to, you know, manage a team in a kitchen, and it's not always kind and it's not always supportive, and it's all about getting the food absolutely perfect and getting it out on time. I imagine being in a Zen kitchen is very different. So what's it like, and how do you maintain that Zen?
Yeah. So the first part of it that you described, like the scene of intensity and, you know, things going wrong and it being kind of fast paced and a sense of urgency and really people wanting to produce the best quality outcomes. That was all true in that kitchen. But the other side of it was that there was this sense of great care and even love for each other. You know, it reminds me a lot of, I get to work with quite a few business leaders and business executives. And in our culture, and I think in many cultures, there is a strong, almost unconscious belief that we need to be hard on ourselves, that it's only through being tough and hard and critical that things will get done. And I often suggest to the business leaders that I get to work with now that as an experiment, just see if you're kind to yourself, if you're kinder to the people around you, do you notice that productivity decreases or stays the same or does it increase? And almost, you know, invariably, people get more done. We're smarter we want to be kind to ourselves. It's this funny underlying habit. So I think in this kitchen, it was very much a conscious practice of taking care of everything, taking care of the carrots that you were cutting. Every knife was kept sharp and always was put back in the same place. There was a sense of care for the things, for the food, and for the people. There was this sense that we were there. The primary reason we were there was to practice mindfulness, was to practice training our attention.
That's really amazing, because I have a lot of friends who are in the kitchen world, and it's really an issue, and it's sort of understood and established that inside of a kitchen, it's a kind of dictatorship. If you don't get it right, you're out. If you spill your soup, you know, it is your fault, and somebody will yell at you if you spill it on, you know, on their stuff. So it's a really dramatic reframe to think that you can be in an environment that has so demanding. It has such high standards with, you know, hot food, dangers around, things that have to be done on time, on the moment, to precision, and still be able to do it with love, support, and kindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I go back to that kitchen. In fact, a year ago, I did a 3-month retreat and went back to spend a 3-month practice period at Tassajara. And I was really surprised, I must say, that the role I was assigned for the afternoon was they put me in charge of the kitchen. and it had been quite a few years. And it was kind of amazing, especially after all of the work that I've done in starting, you know, I've started and run 3 different companies now, and I've done a lot of coaching and consulting work. And in some way, I often quite consciously kind of refer back and lean back to those lessons and that feeling of the Zen kitchen. I actually think that was one of the things that very much made the Search Inside Yourself program that, as you alluded to, that I helped develop inside of Google, that it was some of those kind of embodied sense of care and love, and also this quality, this kind of strange quality of not having to be an expert and not having to be right. So it's interesting to, like, especially in the kitchen, to have these high aspirations, to really want to produce the best quality food, but also we were there, I think, to produce the best quality people. And it was very clear we certainly weren't going to sacrifice the people for the food, and we weren't going to sacrifice the food for the people, that somehow both were incredibly important and we had to take care of them both.
So Mark, you spent time at Google creating an emotional intelligence program for Google. Now, for some people, that might seem like a bit of an oxymoron. You've got all of these engineers coding all day long to create this big tech behemoth, and here you are introducing mindfulness. Can you tell us a little bit about how that experience went and anything that you noticed arising and how the culture accepted it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that I was terrified at first. That I think, as often happens, people assume that I have a lot more experience in things than I actually have. But I really ended up feeling great connection and admiration for these Google engineers, who were super smart, kind people. One of the expressions often used in the Google mindfulness trainings that I did was people would say they were very happy to be able to take off their game faces. That there was a sense of, you know, needing to be a competitive and in a particular role at Google, which I think is true of many, many company cultures. And that in the trainings that I was helping to lead, they could take them off and just show up as human beings who, you know, had hopes and dreams and fears and greed and hatred and all those things, and that we could kind of talk about what was most important to them and how was it going in their work and what were they appreciating and what were they struggling with. And that was really, really, really valuable. And I think that people got that so much of the work that happens at Google, and again, I think pretty much in most of corporate life these days, is working in teams and often working across cultures, where being able to connect, to collaborate, and listen was just hugely, hugely important. We would teach people some very basic meditation practices, listening practices, and kind of unpack things like what their values are and what their visions are of for themselves and for the organization, that through these different exercises and explorations, it really helped them to feel more a sense of connection, a little bit less stressed, or at least having some good tools to deal with a stressful environment. And in some way, my particular aspiration was to bring in some of that magic that I felt like I had been privy to in working in a Zen monastery, and bring that into the life of a Google engineer as much as I possibly could.
Yeah, well, when you think about somebody who spends most of their time, you know, in front of a screen trying to code something, you tend to think of something that is quite lonely and isolating. You know, my first time on the Google campus, I was most struck by the toothbrushes in the bathrooms, meaning mm-hmm. that people literally had to spend that much of their life at the office.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that made it even more important that while they were there, that the culture was one of connection and trust, as opposed to people feeling not so connected.
Well, I definitely have to tip my hat to Chad Mentang, lovely friend of mine, who is also one of, I guess, your co-founder in creating Search Inside Yourself. He was Google's Jolly Good Fellow, and it's his mission to bring world peace in his lifetime. And he was working at Google as a young engineer and luckily, you know, succeeded very, very well from Google's early successes. And he turned around and said, you know, my mission is to make the world a better place, and I can actually do that within Google.
Yeah, I have much appreciation for his vision. And also, especially in the early days of bringing in these programs, it took quite a bit of tenacity on his part. These programs were not just immediately embraced by Google management. It took some time to prove their benefits, and he really hung in there.
Like, how did Larry and Sergey respond to this sort of thing initially?
I think they tolerated it initially. And there was a time when I think the budgets were kind of almost non-existent, and people like me said, "So what? I'm happy to do this work. I don't care about the money. Let's develop the program and see what happens." And I knew that we had turned a corner when I went and had tea at Google with an old friend who was part of their marketing department there, and he showed me the brochure that bragged about how one of the perks at this company was that you could take mindfulness programs like Search Inside Yourself. And I was like, yes.
Now,
these have been sort of integrated into the overall Google culture. And I didn't even know that. This came as a surprise to me.
Well, it's been a huge shift in culture that big companies like Google have embraced mindfulness, and it's made it safe for other big companies and then small companies too. So you and Meng were really on the vanguard in creating this program, getting it disseminated, and then creating a model which demonstrates that it could work.
Yeah, I think that the Google name had a big part of kind of helping with the credibility of mindfulness programs and mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs. And then I also think, though, that Meng and I and a team created a particular, I think especially this, you know, which is practice number 3 in my book, the don't be an expert, that we weren't standing up in front of Google engineers as the experts. We were standing up in front of the engineers as practitioners, as people that were making our best effort to practice, and that this was about doing our best to be full, thriving, caring human beings, and to wanting the best for them in their, not only in their work lives, but in all parts of their lives.
That's awesome. I also like how you guys just took a moment and undermined the Google name and all of its prowess by then calling this the silly Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute.
Yes. Yes, that was, I think that was, again I think a subpart of not only not being an expert, but making fun of yourself.
Yeah, that's very Meng to call something silly.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. We're going to take a little break now to give a shout out to Care Of, this week's pretty cool sponsor. They have a monthly subscription vitamin service with personalized vitamins and supplements delivered to your home each month. The vitamins come in handy little daily packets that make it super easy for you. You start by taking their online quiz that asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices to find out exactly what you need, and then they put your personalized packets together. They also have nutrient-packed quick stick powders that can give you an extra boost when you need it. I've had my packs delivered for months now, and I am loving it. Head to takecareof.com and enter UNTANGLE50 to get 50% off your first month. That's takecareof.com and enter UNTANGLE50 to get your discount. Now, back to our show.
So what's it like being an employee inside of a Mark Lesser company? You know, I imagine these are San Francisco-style startups where you have a ton of pressure and investors and, you know, require performance. What was it like having you as a leader, and what were the things that you did to, you know, create culture in your employees?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. One of the things that we did was a yearly well-being survey at the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. One of the things that I felt like I was really good at was creating a really great culture, that people loved the culture that I and we all, I felt like we all created it together. There was actually real love and caring amongst the employees. Mm-hmm. And I looked forward to our Tuesday morning staff meetings, in which often we would practice a mindful listening exercise of having people just practice speaking about usually some personal issue. Sometimes it was a business issue or a strategy issue, but often it was a personal issue. And people just getting to know each other and kind of cultivating trust.
So what are some of the pieces of advice that you give to people who want to be mindful leaders about their staff?
I tell them to read my book. Come on.
Obviously, that's why you wrote a book. So to give people who are listening a taste of why they should read the book and what they're going to learn, some little tidbits that they'll salivate to and want to go and read more.
You know, people often ask me, well, what's my definition of mindfulness? How do I define mindfulness? And I could almost define mindfulness through these 7 practices that mindfulness is about love. Mindfulness is about loving, cultivating greater awareness and serving others. Mindfulness is about cultivating a beginner's mind and not thinking that we need to be right or that we need to be an expert. Mindfulness is about turning toward what's difficult, what's difficult in our own common humanity and what's difficult in our day-to-day business. And so much of mindfulness is about relationship, is about this practice of how we skillfully depend on others, empower others, and are empowered by others. And then over and over again, mindfulness is about presence and having a different relationship with our human life, being able to keep coming back to making it simpler, keep coming back to what really is important? What really matters? What really matters in all parts of our lives, in our relationship life, with our families, and in our businesses? What matters?
That's fantastic. Let's start digging into those a little bit, and let's start with the first one. So love. Now, love can be a very contentious word when you're in a company. When you're talking amongst employees, love is typically seen as a taboo for all sorts of reasons. I know I've recently begun a practice where whenever I'm about to have an interaction with an employee, whether it's writing an email or a direct interaction, I think about my love for them platonically, just my appreciation for them, my appreciation for them as a human, and I feel the sensation of love in my heart. And since I've started that practice, it has made a dramatic difference in my relationships. Mm-hmm. I remember the day that I started it, I got an email from somebody and I was about to write a somewhat snippy reply. Like, they hadn't done some stuff that I was expecting and I was feeling frustrated. And I'm like, okay, we're going to apply this methodology. I thought about love before, my love of them before I wrote the email. And all of a sudden I had so much appreciation for them and what they'd done and so much appreciation for their skills and the pressure that they were under. And the email that I wrote back was completely different. And I was so sold after that moment, I realized I had to do this with everyone all the time. But when you walk into a company and you say, okay, guys, we're going to up the love, people obviously balk. You know, this isn't something I'm doing, you know, internally with myself, not something I would even encourage my employees to do, because I feel like there's, you know, a piece of taboo there. So talk us through this.
Love might not be the right word everywhere for every person and situation. But I think it is for a lot more, I think, than people realize.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of, you know, when I was first involved with bringing mindfulness to the huge German-based software company, SAP, that every person that we approached about bringing mindfulness in said the same thing, which was, well, I'm ready. I'm really interested in these self-awareness practices, in these emotional intelligence practices, but the companies, no, they're not ready. And each person over and over again said the same thing. And I suspect we'd find the same in many companies about love, right? The kind of love I'm talking about is a kind of care and a kind of trust. You know, I've noticed that there's an awful lot of cynicism in companies. It has to be something beyond even your idea or your intention. It's about embodying that I really care about these people. So like this practice, I love the way you described, it's like a shift of kind of shining that light, that kind of internal light and that external light in our relationships, a kind of radical caring.
Yeah. And you said another really important word, which I think is so often lost within employee cultures, and that's trust. And this lesson was taught to me. So I stepped down as the CEO of the company that I founded, and then somebody else who had actually been in a company before. The company I founded was the first company I'd ever worked in. And he became the CEO, Derek. And I learned so much from his wisdom and leadership. And one of the very first things that he did was he got together the senior team and said, we all need to trust each other fundamentally. And I believed that I trusted everybody in the room. I believed we trusted one another. But it's not the same as really putting it out on the table and putting all of your hesitation, all of your uncertainty on the table and looking around the room at the people there and saying, maybe I don't right at this moment because deep trust needs to be earned, but I intend to build trust deeply with each and every person here. And I intend to have each and every person's back and they will have mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when that happened, it was huge, a huge shift. So share with us trust and how you helped build it.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but bring in, you know, some of the core players in my book are what I've labeled the nervous apes. And this came from one of my Google scientist friends who was fond of saying that we human beings are descendants of the nervous apes. You know, the apes are descendants that were calm and chill and were not scanning for threats. They all got killed. So I think it's important to recognize why this trust word can be so challenging, that we are incredibly sensitive creatures, and we are very sensitive to anything that feels like a threat or anything where someone says something, but they're not embodying it. I mean, I've worked quite a bit with leaders who just didn't understand why people didn't trust them. But you could just see how they were holding kind of anger. They were holding a kind of not really trusting themselves, not being comfortable in their own skin, and creating separateness from the people around them, as opposed to creating a sense of trust and connection. So I think it's important to put out there that it's not easy. And it's not like, oh, now I've created trust, now I can relax. No, it's an ongoing, never-ending practice, the practice of creating trust, especially in the business world where results matter, where sometimes people make mistakes. You know, we miss our revenue profit objectives, and we have to have difficult conversations, and there can be a good deal of stress. So in the midst of that cauldron, and again, this kind of, I'm going to refer back to the Tassajara kitchen, mm-hmm. that if you truly realize that you have this dual mission of growing the business and growing people, and that if you really pay attention to how important each of those are, then this is, I think, a key component of building greater trust.
Are there any exercises or simple things that one can do within a company to encourage greater trust?
It sounds almost trite, but it's so important and so powerful, which is to cultivate your ability to listen, like to really listen. And part of that is noticing when we're not listening. And by listening, it's like noticing when we're formulating our own ideas or our own response, wanting to look good, wanting to look smart, and somehow training ourselves to empty our minds of that and to really just be there and ask what's really being said here. What is the idea being put forth here? And as well as, who is this other person? You know, what does this person value? What are their strengths? What are their growth points? And to be super tuned in and curious about other people, just a great skill. I think still to this day, it's one of the most surprising things that I do when I work with teams or inside of companies, is to see how much people don't listen. It's this huge breath of fresh air when we can shift toward being more curious about other people and allow for the stories to emerge. So important, I think, in both in problem solving in companies and also in creating new ideas, is being able to have a listening environment.
Yeah, and you brought up another incredibly good point, and that's when somebody is not worried about making themselves the smartest in the room or looking the best, that's when the best work gets done. Mm-hmm. And so often, I mean, we can all imagine work situations in which somebody is out for themselves and not for the team, or somebody's trying to look good and overtalks or undertalks or overshares or undershares. And it then becomes really difficult to work with that mm-hmm. person. How do you deal with a situation in which somebody's ego is in place, and these situations, you know, happen so naturally because we all want to get ahead and we want to get ahead and work and we want to be seen? How do you manage those desires and needs?
It's interesting. I feel like I've often had the great fortune of being, you know, the CEO of the companies that I started, and you really get to set the kind of expectations around this issue of emotional intelligence and around balancing. You know, you want each person on the team to be representing their particular perspective and their particular point of view, but you also want them to be able and to be able to see from the perspective of the team or from the perspective of the company. Sometimes this requires ongoing mentoring and coaching for people who are not used to that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it requires having some difficult conversations. And sometimes it's actually even more powerful if it doesn't come from me as the CEO, but it comes from people's peers, to be able to have these peer-to-peer conversations and to speak openly and honestly about the need for being a team player and for depending and trusting each other. Kind of like what you were saying about the CEO that came into your company to just to put it out there, And to keep part of that means, you know, being able to speak up skillfully when we see that it's not happening, and to very skillfully be able to recognize how good it feels when people are being a team player.
It really is amazing. It feels so great when you are literally all on the same team. And it takes so much skill and cultivation to truly create a team. And you can feel when our chemistry is off and when our chemistry is on. And we really truly have each other's back. And we are all in this together, and we're all gunning in the same direction. There may be dissent. And of course, dissent is natural, but it's this dissent with everybody's intentions facing in the same direction, which is kind of simultaneously towards one another and all together towards the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes kind of creating a safe space, a safe and caring space, but also combined with this strange mix of, there also needs to be kind of a sense of urgency and a sense of, you know, how we use our time matters, prioritizing matters, results matter, and people matter, and mentoring, coaching, mindfulness, emotional intelligence, it's all like not pitting them against each other, but driving them all into a kind of culture and presence.
My name's Dwayne Osterlin. I'm host of the Addicted Mind podcast. Are you ready to uncover the science of breaking addiction? Then join me on the Addicted Mind, where compassion meets innovation. We're going to explore real stories of addiction recovery, hear from real experts on science-based treatment, and you'll be able to equip yourself with the tools for lasting change. So whether you're on the road to recovery yourself or walking alongside someone who is, the Addicted Mind podcast is your companion. So check it out. Subscribe on whatever podcast app you're using right now and be part of the conversation that's changing lives.
So some of the people listening may be leaders themselves, and like I did, drink in this information and say, wow, okay, this is reframing how I want to change, support my team. A lot of the people listening may be employees in possibly functional or possibly highly dysfunctional cultures and environments. And they may feel powerless to be able to make these changes or to bring these ideas up to a supervisor who doesn't themselves seem to have the emotional intelligence to hear, listen, manage, or understand. So what recommendations or insights would you give to somebody who's an employee situation?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that sometimes I notice that people don't get that no matter where you are in the company, there's always someone above you, you know, that, and you're always, you know, and I think often people who are not in leadership situations, I think it's a real skill, I think, of managing up, of really paying attention to what are the stressors and motivators of the person or people that you are reporting to. Because even the CEO is reporting to a board of directors. And that this issue, being super tuned into alignment, to be able to align your particular activities with what's most needed of the people you're working with. You know, one of the skills in the early days of the mindfulness programs that I used to teach at Google, we had a whole section on what we called a political awareness. and because in a way, it's actually in the emotional intelligence model, it is, I think it comes, it probably comes under, you know, social skills or communication skills, because it's about managing up, managing across, and managing down. It's getting as clear as we can about what is the culture here, what are the norms and rules and communication styles, and in what way can I influence, and influence in a positive way, and in what ways, you know, is that just not going to happen because these things, it's just too much of a gap between the way I'd like to see things be and the way things are. But how are things, to really to be as crisp and clear as you can about what is actually happening, and what can you, what even what baby steps can you take, what shifts can you make? Now, it's also important, I think, to state that there are toxic environments, right? There are environments that are just really difficult to be in, and that it might be that you're just not going to change those, and then you have to make decisions about is there any way to make this a better place to work? Or is it time to be looking for a different environment? That is a reality of the business world. And so much of the research about people's experience in the workplace has to do with the team that they work on, and in particular, who their manager is. So I think it's a worthwhile endeavor and experiment to try to train and retrain your manager as much as possible if that particular person needs some greater self-awareness, some greater emotional intelligence. But sometimes we have to make hard decisions.
Well, the good news is we seem to be entering into an era where companies are actively seeking out and bringing in mindfulness teachings. I know at Muse, we often run corporate programs. I know at Search Inside Yourself, you run corporate programs. And Mark, you coach many companies. And so we're seeing the opportunity for companies to sort of wake up and say, hey, these practices really matter. And they improve my employee retention, because people listening will leave if they don't like the company they're in. And so talk a little bit about the opportunities that you see with a company-wide mindfulness program to try to shift a company. What examples have you experienced?
Yeah, I think particularly, younger people, the millennial generation is really demanding a greater sense of self-awareness, emotional intelligence, mindfulness. One of my favorite case studies was a mindfulness and emotional intelligence training that I did with a 60-person company, and they were a wealth management organization, quite successful, but quite conventional, one where their leadership team and management team were kind of old school. But there was one person in the company that wanted to bring me and the work that I was doing in. And we got everyone in the company, actually 59 out of 60 people came to a 2-day mindfulness and emotional intelligence training. And I like it. I really like it when a lot of people come in, especially senior management, are skeptical. Skeptical, but willing to be open to see what happens. And at the end of that 2 days, this company culture was completely kind of opened up. And even the senior leaders were like, wow, like their experience changed from a skepticism about creating more safety and more trust while keeping that sense of urgency. And they really got it. And they ended up, at the end of 2 days, they formed a variety of committees, and they wanted to make sure that they really drilled down and looked at what were the specific actions they could take to make sure that some of the practices, tools, attitudes that they had learned were going to be integrated and sustained in the company. So like one of the things they did, they started changing how they did meetings. They made sure that at the beginning of every meeting, there was maybe 30 seconds or a minute of just being quiet. They tended, whenever possible, to start meetings with doing something where there was some kind of connection, some kind of human connection, as opposed to what they previously were doing was right into strategy and agenda and problem solving, where people weren't feeling so connected. So I often think of that company as a great case study.
That's great. Some of the examples that we do in that same direction at Muse is often before meetings, we'll do a gratitude round. So we'll just very quickly go and share gratitude to somebody in the room. Mm-hmm. Or we might do a drop-in and just set our intention for the meeting. And it's incredible how the 30 seconds changes your meeting. You all now intend to be here in the room and together work on some end, as opposed to three people still being on their laptop because they hadn't switched modes.
Right. Yeah, I think that kind of intentional transition, that kind of it's like setting the table for the meal that's about to happen. And it just shows that someone's paying attention here. Someone cares. We're not just a random group of people that are going to have a conversation. No, this time together matters. And the way that we are being connected with each other matters. So this, again, very much like that magic that I felt going back to the Zen monastery kitchen.
So let's go back to your history a little bit, because it's quite interesting. So when you were doing your MBA, were you considering these ideas? How did the two kind of become married for you?
I think I wanted to be steeped in the language of business, which I hadn't been at that point, right? That I went right from university to the Zen Center. And even though, you know, my big aha, especially when I was Tassajara director, was that I was running a business and that I wanted to bring these practices into the business world, but that I needed more of a business education. I think it was in my first business. So I started 30 years ago, exactly to this, almost to this day, I started a greeting card and calendar publishing company called Brush Dance. We were one of the first companies in the world to make things out of recycled paper.
This was
30 years ago, 1989.
Amazing.
Yeah, and I literally started that company here in my house in Mill Valley, and it grew to be, you know, we were creating and distributing millions of greeting cards all around the world, despite that, you know, I rarely bought or sent a greeting card. But it was that experience of building that company from the ground up that I first started being able to explore, experiment, and learn about building a great culture. And I learned a lot, yeah. And that I spent 15 years as the CEO of Brushdance.
How do you reconcile what we typically think of in Buddhism as, you know, a non-materialism, non-yearning for money, and the business world, which is so set up on materialism and on capital gain? How do you resolve that tension in yourself?
The way I think about it is that it's important to remember that pretty much all businesses are essentially there to serve people, right? Business is there to provide goods or services to other human beings, that it's about business is essentially about helping others. And that if you do it well, you can create monetary success. You can create greater wealth. And that, you know, the very first book that I wrote, I don't know, 20-something years ago, was called ZBA, Zen of Business Administration, which that title kind of started out as a joke because I was once introduced as having my ZBA degree. And the first part of that book is entitled, "We Are All Zen Students and We Are All Business People." And we're all Zen students in that, you know, we are all born, we'll all go through many different transitions, and we will all die. Therefore, we are all Zen students. And Zen is essentially the study of human beings. And we're all business people, in that there's no avoiding the material world. There's no avoiding the need to make a living, the need to deal with money. I experienced this even running a Zen monastery kitchen. I had to make the menus and the budgets and order food and keep within certain parameters. And I think that the world of money and the world of work, the material world, is just a fantastic place to practice with mindfulness and with emotional intelligence.
Certainly, if there is a point of the world that required more emotional intelligence, it is how we behave and act around money. I mean, it is the thing that drives us towards scarcity thinking. It is the thing that drives our unpleasant behaviors towards one another. It is the thing that tends to strip us of our humanity because we become focused on the money and not the people who benefit from it, exist in it, or required to generate it. So, you know, certainly a balance between Buddhism and, you know, between mindful principles and monetary principles is required in this world. And I'd say is sorely lacking in many cases.
Yeah, well, you know, greed, hate, and delusion have been very popular for thousands of years.
Possibly more.
And I think it's in us, the ability to be greedy and fearful and hateful is kind of baked into us. But I think also the ability to be loving and compassionate is also baked into us. And I think it's a profound aha to recognize that It's a choice. And then it's a practice. How do we practice with recognizing our own greed, recognizing our own fears? It's not so good to pretend that they aren't there and that we don't feel them and that we have to contend with them. It's so easy to lose track of what our business is really about, and to have the focus be on money, and to lose sight of that the primary reason that your company exists is to serve people.
It's comprised of people, to serve people. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for opening our eyes to how we can shift from some of those sensations of greed and ego and the desire to, excel within the company, to turn towards our colleagues, our peers, and try to act in more loving ways, or as the employer, recognize the value of creating some love and support and trust and safety within our teams.
Yeah. Thank you, Ariel. What a pleasure to get to hang out with you.
Total pleasure. So if, like me, you're fascinated by how we create more mindfulness within teams, I highly recommend checking out The 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader. And where, Mark, can we learn more about you specifically?
I can be found at marklesser.net, marklesser.net.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for letting us inside your mind.
Thank you, Ariel. It wasn't too scary, I hope.
It wasn't too scary at all. You did let us know that you and all of us have some greed inside of our brains, which may be a difficult truth to confront, but I think we'll all be okay with it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. As Mark mentioned, you can find out more about Mark and how he creates mindful workplaces, whether they be kitchens, offices, or otherwise, at marklesser.net. That's marklesser.net. You can also pick up his new book, The 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader. You can grab it on Amazon or go support your favorite local bookseller. If you're curious about Muse and how it can support your meditation practice, you can find it at choosemuse.com, and you can use the discount code UNTANGLE15. I'm Ariel Garten, and Patricia will be back next week with more Untangle. Till then, keep your neurons sparkling.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.